Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Have a lot of exploring to do. Some original commentaries that I've written that I'll share with you on the nature of the conflict, Islamophobia, and asking a larger, overarching question. Are the major religions of the world capable of genocide? I'll explore that. Plus, from the Oxford Debating Society, Mahdi Hassan challenging three panelists who are clearly opposed to Islam, believe it's a religion of violence, will have his comments, then my commentary following that. We're going to find out about child abuse or vaccine-induced rickets. Doctors have had it wrong all along. A lot of parents have suffered because of what the vaccines did. Christina England from Health Impact News. A new study finds that GMO soy is toxic to your kidneys, liver, and reproduction. Five warming spices that raise your body temperature. Eat more whole grains to reduce cardiovascular disease and total death. Well, hold on. Didn't we just have Dr. Perlmutter saying grains are a major culprit? Who's saying otherwise? Harvard School of Public Health in a major study. And I also endorse a whole grain diet. We'll go into it in depth. Benefiting from the common root vegetables. This and more. On the environment, scientists confirm that radiation has finally reached the west coast of the United States. We mentioned this would be coming, and it'll be getting worse throughout the year. The National Academy of Sciences just reported on this. Some really good news. There has been an energy crash. 97% of fracking now operating at a loss at current oil prices. So we will look at this piece from the Daily Cause. And those speculators who got in it just because they thought it was a good way of making money, but destroying the environment and the habitat, people's health, well, now they're getting a payback. My guest in the second part of our program is Professor Janine Waddell. She is a social anthropologist and professor in the School of Public Policy, Government and International Affairs at George Mason University in Washington. Her research focuses on corruption in models of governance and the influence of elite individuals and entities. We're going to talk about the emergence of something new and more sophisticated and terrible. It's a power structure. It is utterly corrupt, and it is undermining our democracy and infiltrating every single level of society. You haven't heard about it? This will be a unique discussion. You won't want to miss that. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. There was a program that came out about 25 years ago about eating for your blood type. And for the average person, it made sense that some people were better off having meat and a lot of it, others having vegetables, others some combination. And it became a best-selling book, and it was popular. So then I decided, as a nutritionist, a dietitian, and as a scientist, and as a clinician, let's just see if it works. It may, but what if it doesn't? One of the very first lessons I learned in science was when I thought I had discovered something important, that all vegetables have complete protein, meaning they contain all 8 essential amino acids, essential because your body cannot produce those particular amino acids, a 9th in pregnancy, but 8 for the average person. You have to eat them, get them exogenously outside of the body and bring them in. And my research showed that all plants, grains, legumes, nuts, seeds, berries, they all have all 8 essential amino acids in varying percentages. And by learning how to combine them, we could then no longer have to have any animal proteins whatsoever in our diet. And when I presented this information, the very first thing that the chief scientist said was, "Now disprove yourself." I didn't know what he was talking about. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you think you've discovered something important, but what if you've made an error? What we need to do now is see if you're as diligent in trying to deconstruct your arguments as you were in constructing them." So for the next 3 months, I did everything I could and then gave it out to other people to do as the best they could in finding errors in what I had done. I couldn't, and it was accepted, and that became the Egg Project. And from that moment forward, there has been a strong scientific body of evidence for those who choose it to prove that you no longer ever have to eat anything from an animal in order to gain all the protein and nutrition that you need to live a longer and vital life. But then I began to apply that same principle to everything in life. So I send out every manuscript to my critics before it's published, because maybe they can find errors I've overlooked, biases that I wasn't aware of. I do the same thing with my documentaries. I bring in individuals, not my friends, and I say to them, "Tear it to pieces. That's all. Just tear it apart. Show me what's wrong with it." And they do. And then I go back and see if it's legitimate, their criticism, in which case I make corrections. You have to keep the ego and keep it from being personal out of the equation. So when I was told that there's a blood type, I simply put it to the test. We had thousands of individuals enrolled in a series of health support groups. That we had so many health support groups, we were doing them 7 days a week, 2 to 3 per day. There was a time when we had 21 groups going on at one time, but they all were on the same identical diet, and it was a vegan diet, but it was organic, and it was whole grain and whole legume. No powders, no refined, no white rice, brown rice. And at the end of that study, which was over 5 years, we found statistically significant improvement in everything from diabetes to heart disease to cancer to arthritis to dementia, across the board, every condition imaginable, as long as the people adhered to the protocol, improved. So that put to, from my perspective, that put to rest the idea that there is a special blood type. There isn't. And so when I saw this best-selling book and a very charismatic person who I know and who I believe is a very capable and competent physician. He specializes in helping people with Parkinson's because he is a board-certified neurologist and a very good one, Dr. Perlmutter, and he was opposed to grains. So now you have to ask, well, is it all grains? Because there are nutritionists who are opposed to grains, even whole grains. And when you take gluten out of the equation and you take refining out of the equation, so what you're left with are whole grains, you find out there's no health problems. To the contrary, when I traveled throughout Europe and saw that they were eating whole grains, they had none of the conditions at the levels we have here, especially the itises, ileitis, colitis, Crohn's, spastic colon. Now we have this from Harvard School of Public Health, quote, "Whole grains form a part of many diets deemed to be beneficial for health, such as the Mediterranean diet. But what health benefits do whole grains offer in their own right? According to a new study, eating more of them may reduce death, particularly deaths resulting from cardiovascular disease. Grains are made up of 3 parts, the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. Refined grains often have the bran layer and germ removed, while whole grains contain all 3 elements. Foods that contain whole grains include oatmeal, cornmeal, bulgur, brown rice, whole wheat flour. In general, whole grains are thought to be better for health than refined grains as part of a healthy diet. Whole grains have been associated with reduced blood cholesterol and improve weight maintenance. Quote, compared with refined carbohydrates, whole grains contain many beneficial nutrients and phytochemicals that primarily reside in the outer layers of the grains that are removed during milling processes to produce refined whole grains. End quote from Dr. Wu, Harvard School of Public Health in Boston. Now they found this. Now this is the takeaway message, and this is important. Quote, this is from the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. This is a big study, the Nurses' Health Study. There were actually two studies. 74,341 women were evaluated from 1984 to 2010, and the Men's Health Professional Follow-Up Study of 43,744 doctors between 1986 and 2010. So you're dealing with a 25-year study with over 100,000 individuals. Here's what they found. Quote, each serving of whole grains was linked to a 5% lower total death risk. That's a terrific reduction in death. In fact, it was 9% lower risk of dying if you ate just 28 grams of whole grain in cardiovascular disease. 28 grams is an ounce. 20.35 grams is an ounce. So you're talking about a tiny amount of grains could have such enormous benefit. So if you want to help prevent yourself from dying of heart disease, eat organic whole grains like brown rice. So that's good news. I remember seeing a little handwritten note. It was on a stained yellow piece of paper. And what it said was that I'm in prison, I'm in deep solitary, which I didn't know what that meant at the time. It meant that he was in isolation because he would have been at risk from other prisoners killing him. His name was Alan Yerko, and he said, I'm innocent, I did not kill my baby. That sat on my desk because of all the other priorities, so I did read it until I could get caught up on the documentaries, the counseling, everything else I was doing. And then one day I looked in greater depth. I reached out, managed to reach his wife, wanted to hear the whole story. So for now, I just listened. Then I spoke with the attorney that represented him, got that story. And then just intuitively, something just said, take the case. And I did. And I went down to Florida, looked into it in depth, and within a week, it was apparent this man was innocent, that his baby had been the victim of a hot lot, meaning a defective lot vaccine. And over the next several years, there was an effort made with lots of science to show that he deserved a new trial. He got a new trial. And some of the great advocates, medical advocates, came in to testify on his behalf. Dr. Carrie Katordis from Australia came in, and at least four others. He was found innocent of all charges. He was released. He was a free man. Afterwards, one of the people who testified said, you realize he's only one of thousands who are in prison today for vaccine-related death, but they were charged with shaken baby syndrome. I give that as background because this is something new. This is from Christina England. Quote, thousands of parents worldwide are being falsely accused of child abuse after doctors discovered what they believe to be a healing fractures on x-rays. However, far from being abused, there is growing evidence to support the claim that many of these children are in fact suffering from infantile rickets. Rickets is a condition caused by a severe lack of vitamin D in the diet, which can lead to a softening and weakening of the bones, making it difficult for the body to absorb calcium. One doctor who is unafraid to speak out on the subject is Dr. David Abode, a practicing radiologist from Springfield, Illinois. He believes that it is not only poor diet and a lack of sunshine that is responsible for the growing number of children suffering from rickets, but also the growing number of vaccinations containing the adjuvant aluminum. He's an expert on the subject, has been involved in hundreds of cases of misdiagnosed rickets worldwide, and has testified on behalf of many innocent parents. During an interview with Dr. Joseph Mercola, he talked about the vast experience, and then he goes into depth about how, quote, for the last 25 years, we've seen rickets on x-rays of infants with fractures, and from the very beginning of this, including out of Boston Children's Hospital, there has been a misdiagnosis or a diagnostic substitution. And then he goes on to talk about how that these are primarily due to the vaccines and mercury. Quote, here's what he says. He says that I've looked closely at aluminum adjuvants and vaccines and their association with diseases in early infancy. One of the classic diseases that aluminum is linked to is rickets. It is also plausible that aluminum is anticoagulant. In other words, it can induce bleeding conditions. And then it goes in to talk about this in depth. So the question is, why aren't we paying attention to this? So what I'm suggesting now is I will post this article and all the evidence linking aluminum and vaccine-induced rickets. It's extremely strong. So within the community where parents have had damage to their children because of vaccines, into the autism community, into all those who have had some type of negative impact with vaccines, please take a moment. Take a look at the evidence. Pregnant mothers are being advised to receive vaccinations containing aluminum during pregnancy. And baby formulas are known to contain high quantities of aluminum, especially those being fed to premature babies. And many babies are vaccinated at birth with the hepatitis B vaccine, which contains aluminum. And they continue to receive additional multiple vaccines containing aluminum, whether they are premature or not, from the age of 8 weeks. So given the evidence, is it any wonder that the health of our vulnerable babies is suffering from conditions believed to be a thing of the past, such as rickets and scurvy, which are being diagnosed today, and the parents being arrested, tried, put in jail, their children taken away, when they have done nothing wrong except trust the officials and given them the vaccines? That's the latest on health and nutrition, except one final thing, one more reason why you should only eat organic and never eat GMO soy, is because, quote, in North America, approximately 75 to 89% of soybeans are grown genetically. And the latest research shows that rats given GM soy were found to have deadly amounts of toxicity in their kidneys, liver, testes, sperm, blood, and even DNA. Is there any question anymore about the true poisons that our biotech industries have put upon us? The answer is no. I promised at the beginning to give you 5 warming spices, and because it's so cold in some places in America, I just want to give these. Here they are. Cardamom. I love the way it smells, too. It has a great fragrance, and it's indigenous to South India and Sri Lanka, and it has concentrations of natural cinnol. It's an expectorant, meaning it helps you loosen mucus and get it out of your lungs. And it also stimulates our body temperature. It helps digestion and elimination of gas. Cinnamon, which is probably one of the most popular seasonings in our society, it's absolutely great because of the tannins in cinnamon, and that helps our body as far as our metabolism. It's also a natural blood thinner. Turmeric, which is also good, ginger, and cayenne. So when you look at cayenne, ginger, turmeric, cinnamon, and cardamom, great seasonings for this time of year. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
bounce, and there you were. With sweet love and devotion, deeply touching my emotions. I want to stop and thank you, baby.
I'd like to welcome all of you from around the world. I'm Gary Nall. We have a really powerful program today. We're going to be listening to new information from Professor Janine Waddell about the emergence of a new, more sophisticated secret structure of power and corruption undermining our democracy and infiltrating every level of society. She's a professor in the School of Policy, Government, International Affairs at George Mason University. We're going to hear in about 14 to 15 minutes. But right now, we're going to hear from the last panelist. There was no video of the first three panelists who were challenging Islam as a religion of violence and intolerance. And here is the one person defending Islam in that debate. He was the last person, Mehdi Hassan. And then we will come back and I will share my own commentary.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Assalamu alaikum. Lovely to see you all here tonight. We are having a very entertaining night, are we not? With some very interesting things being said from the other side of the house tonight. Let me begin by saying, as a Muslim, as a representative of Islam, I would consider myself an ambassador for Islam, a believer in Islam, a follower of Islam and its prophet. So, in that capacity, let me begin by apologizing to Anne-Marie for the Bali bombings. I apologize for the role of my religion and me and my people, for the killing of Theo van Gogh, for 7/7. Yes, that was all of us. That was Islam, that was Muslims, that was the Quran. I mean, astonishing claims to make in the very first speech tonight on a day like today, where the Conservative Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is having to come out and point out that these kind of views are anathema. And I believe you're trying to stand for the Labour Party to become an MP in Brighton. If you do, and you make these comments, I'm guessing you'll have the whip withdrawn from you. But then again, UKIP's on the rise. They'll take you, the BNP. They might have something to say about your views.
This is what Mehdi Hassan always does.
By the way, just on a factual point, since we heard a lot about the second speaker, about how backward we Muslims all are, on a factual point, you said that Islam was born in Saudi Arabia. Islam was born in 610 AD. Saudi Arabia was born in 1932 AD. So you were only 1,322 years off. Not bad? Not bad start there. Talking of maths, by the way, a man named Al-Khawarizmi was one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, a Muslim, worked in the golden age of Islam. He's the guy who came up with not just algebra, but algorithms. Without algorithms, you wouldn't have laptops. Without laptops, Daniel Johnson tonight wouldn't have been able to print out his speech in which he came to berate us Muslims for holding back the advance and intellectual achievements of the West, which all happened without any contribution from anyone else other than the Judeo-Christian people of Europe. In fact, Daniel David Levering, the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of The Golden Crucible, points out that there would be no Renaissance, there would be no Reformation in Europe without the role played by Ibn Sina and Ibn Rushd and some of the great Muslim theologians, philosophers, scientists in bringing Greek text to Europe. As for this being our university, I will leave that to the imagination as to who is our and who is there. I studied here too. An astonishing set of speeches so far making this case tonight. A mixture of just cherry-picked quotes, facts and figures, self-serving, selective, a farrago of distortions, misrepresentations, misinterpretations, misquotations. Daniel talked about my article in the New Statesman, which got me a lot of flack, where I talked about the anti-Semitism that is prevalent in some parts of the Muslim community, which indeed it is. Of course, I didn't say in that piece that it was caused by the religion of Islam. In fact, modern anti-Semitism in the Middle East was imported from, finish the sentence, Christian, Judeo-Christian Europe, where I believe some certainly bad things happened to the Jewish people. In fact, Tom Friedman, Jewish-American columnist in the New York Times, told me in this very chamber last week that he believed, had Muslims been running Europe in the 1940s, 6 million extra Jews would still be alive today. So I'm not going to take lessons in anti-Semitism from someone who's here to defend the Judeo-Christian values of a continent that murdered 6 million Jews. Moving swiftly on. Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm about to make that point. No, I'm about to make that point. You're right. I agree with you 110%. That is my point. I don't think Europe is evil or bad. I'm a very proud European. I don't want to judge Europe on the basis, but if we're going to play this gutter game where we pull out the Bali bombing and we pull out examples of anti-Semitism in the Islamic community, then of course I'm going to come back and say, well, hold on. I mean, look, let's be very clear. Daniel here was a last-minute replacement for Douglas Murray, who had to pull out. And Douglas and I have a well-documented differences, but to be fair to Douglas, as to be fair to Anne-Marie and to Peter, atheists. Atheists see all religions as evil, violent, threatening. What the problem I have with Daniel's speech is that Daniel comes here to mount this robust defense of Christianity, forgetting that his fellow Christians, people who said they were acting in the name of Jesus, gave us the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, the anti-Jewish pogroms, European colonialism in Africa and Asia, the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, not to mention countless arson and bomb attacks on abortion clinics in the United States of America to this very day. I would like a little bit of humility from Daniel first before he begins lecturing other communities and other faiths on violence, terror, and intolerance. But, no thank you. Some water. But I would say this, to address the gentleman's very valid point here, I'm not going to play that game. I don't actually believe that Christianity is a religion of violence and hate because of what the LRA does in Uganda or what Crusaders did to Jews and Muslims in Jerusalem when they took back the city in the 12th or 13th or whatever century it was. I believe that Christianity, like Islam, like pretty much every mainstream religion, is based on love and compassion and faith. I do follow a religion in which 113 out of the 114 chapters of the Quran begins by introducing the God of Islam as a God of mercy and compassion. I would not have it any other way. I don't follow a religion which introduces my God to me as a God of war, as some kind of Greek God of wrath, as a God of hate and injustice. Not at all. As Adam pointed out, you go through the Quran and you see the mercy and the love and the justice. And yes, you have verses that refer to warfare and violence. Of course it does. This is not a motion about pacifism. I'm not here to argue that Islam is a pacifistic faith. It is not. Islam allows military action, violence, in certain limited contexts. And yes, a minority of Muslims do take it out of that context. But is it religious? We talked about Woolwich. Daniel and Anne-Marie have suggested that it's definitely religion that's behind all of this. Well, actually, what I find so amusing tonight is we're having a debate about Islam, and the opposition tonight have come forward. We have a graduate in law, a graduate in modern history, a graduate in chemistry, and you know, I admire all of their intellects and their abilities, but we don't have anyone who's actually an expert on Islam, a scholar of Islam, a historian of Islam, a speaker of Arabic, even a terrorism expert or a security expert or a pollster, let alone to talk about what Muslims believe or think. Instead, we have people coming here, putting forward these views, putting forward these sweeping opinions. Listen to Professor Robert Pape of the University of Chicago, one of America's leading terrorism experts, who, unlike our esteemed opposition tonight, studied every single case of suicide terrorism between 1980 and 2005, 315 cases in total. And he concluded, and I quote, "There is little connection between suicide terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism or any of the world's religions. Rather, what nearly all suicide terrorist attacks have in common is a specific secular and strategic goal to compel modern democracies to withdraw military forces from territory that the terrorists consider to be their homeland." And the irony is, when we talk about terrorism, the irony is that the opposition and the Muslim terrorists, the Al-Qaeda types, actually have one thing in common. Because they both believe that Islam is a warlike, violent religion. They both agree on that. They have everything in common. Osama bin Laden would be nodding along to everything he's heard tonight from the opposition side. He agrees with them. The problem is that mainstream Muslims don't. The majority of Muslims around the world don't. In fact, a gentleman here started quoting all sorts of polls. Gallup carried out the biggest poll of Muslims around the world of 50,000 Muslims in 35 countries. 93% of Muslims rejected 9/11 and suicide attacks. And of the 7% who didn't, they all, when polled and focus grouped, cited political reasons for their support for violence, not religious reasons. And as for Islamic scholars and what they say, well, Daniel talks about our University of Oxford. We'll go down to Oxford's Centre for Islamic Studies, get hold of a man named Sheikh Afifi Al-Akiti, who is a massively well-credentialed and well-respected Islamic scholar, who has studied across the world, who in the days after 7/7 published a fatwa denouncing terrorism in the name of Islam, calling for the protection of all non-combatants at all times, and describing suicide bombings as an innovation with no basis in Islamic law. Go and listen to Sheikh Tahir al-Qadri, one of Pakistan's most famous Islamic scholars, who published a 600-page fatwa condemning the killing of all innocents and all suicide bombings unconditionally without any ifs or buts. There's nothing new here. This is mainstream Islam, mainstream scholarship, which has said this for years. You don't go out and kill people willy-nilly in the high street or anywhere else on a bus or a mall based on verses of the Quran that you cherry-pick without any context, any understanding, any interpretation or any commentary. Please. Well, it
doesn't happen, apparently.
I didn't say it doesn't happen at all. I never said it didn't happen. I don't blame Islam. Yes, it's a very good point. And a lot of us are campaigning against that. And we're campaigning against it in the name of Islam. We're campaigning against it in the name of various interpretations of Islam. Anne-Marie comes and scares us with her talk of Sharia law. I would like to see the book of Sharia law. It doesn't exist. People argue over what Sharia law is. And you empower the extremists by saying there is only one version. You empower them all. I don't believe you
several
took any interruptions, Anne-Marie, so I think you should stay there for a moment.
Here's what we're dealing with.
I took your point. Here we are dealing with a 1,400-year-old global religion followed by 1.6 billion people in every corner of the world, a quarter of humanity, of all backgrounds, cultures, ethnicities, and yet the opposition tonight wants to generalize, stereotype, smear in order to desperately win this debate. And here's my question, if we're going to generalize and smear. Okay, people say yesterday's bombers, and we've got to be careful, there's a trial going on, were yesterday's attackers, motivated by Islam? Big debate. I don't believe they were. Let's say they were. Let's say Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, was motivated by Islam. Let's assume, for sake of argument, that Richard Reeves, the shoe bomber, was motivated by Islam. If Islam is responsible for these killings, if Islam is what is motivating these people, and Islam is therefore not a religion of peace or a religion of war, then ask yourself this question: why aren't the rest of us doing it? Why is it such a tiny minority of Muslims are interpreting their religion in the way that the opposition claim they are? Let's assume there are 16,000 suicide bombers in the world. There aren't. Let's assume there are, for the sake of argument. That's 0.001% of the Muslim population globally. What about the other 99.99% of Muslims who the opposition tonight either ignore or smear? The reality is that the rest of us aren't blowing ourselves up tonight. The reality is that the opposition came here tonight not worried about the fact that me and Adam might pull open our jackets and blow ourselves up tonight because we're followers of a warlike warrior religion which wants to take over Europe and Daniel's university. The issue is this. Unless the opposition can tell us tonight, and Peter Atkins is here, one of our great atheist intellectuals, can tell us tonight, can they answer this question tonight, why don't the vast majority of Muslims around the world behave as violently and aggressively as a tiny minority of politically motivated extremists, then they might as well give up and stop pretending they have anything relevant to say about Islam or Muslims as a whole. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just say this to you. Think about what the opposite of this motion is. If you vote no tonight, think about what you're saying the opposite motion is. That Islam isn't a religion of peace, it's a religion of war, of violence, of terror, of aggression. That the people who follow Islam, me, my wife, my retired parents, my six-year-old child, that 1.8 million of your fellow British residents and citizens, that 1.6 billion people across the world, your fellow human beings, are all followers, promoters, believers in a religion of violence. Do you really think that? Do you really believe that to be the case? They say that in the Oxford Union, the most famous debate was in 1933 when Adolf Hitler looked out for the result of the King and Country motion, where they voted against fighting for King and Country, and Hitler was listening out for the result. Well, tonight, 80 years on, there are two groups of people around the world who I would argue are waiting for the result of tonight's vote. There are the millions of peaceful, non-violent, law-abiding Muslims both in the UK, Europe, Asia, Africa and beyond, who see Islam as the source of their identity, as a source of spiritual fulfillment, of hope, of solace. And there are the phobes, the haters, the bigots out there who want to push the clash of civilizations, who want to divide all of us into them and us and ours and their. Ladies and gentlemen, I urge you all not to fuel the arguments of the phobes and bigots. Don't legitimize their divisions. Don't legitimize their hate. Trust those Muslims who you know, who you've met, who you hear, who don't believe in violence, who do want you to hear the peaceful message of the Quran as they believe it to be taught to the majority of Muslims. The Islam of peace and compassion and mercy. The Islam of the Quran, not of Al-Qaeda. Ladies and gentlemen, I beg to propose this motion to the House. I urge you to vote yes tonight. Thank you very much for your time.
In a moment, my commentary on his statements. But before we go there, and then after that to our guest, we have one special today. I want to give this special out, and I'm sorry that we have been out of stock, but we make this in small batches because it's so big. It's a gallon jug. It is our survival stuff, and we've been out of it now for about almost a month and a half. We only got 200 jars in. Now, why should you be interested in survival stuff? Well, because, quite frankly, I know of no other product in the world, anywhere, at any price, that has everything that's so important for our well-being in one single jar, in one serving. You're getting the pea protein and brown rice protein and alfalfa and pumpkin seeds and flax seeds and barley grass and carrots and kale and cauliflower and cabbage and parsley and ginger and spinach and celery and broccoli and asparagus, collard greens, apples, bananas, cranberries, strawberries, chlorella, spirulina, blueberries and blackberries and raspberries and kamut and oats and sprouted non-glutenized grains like quinoa and kamut and spelt and amaranth and oat beta-glucan and chia seeds and seaweeds like alaria and dulse and laminaria and five different types of digestive enzymes like papain and bromelain and amylase and lipase and cellulase and protease and 8 billion non-dairy probiotics. So where do you get this? This is everything you could possibly imagine to give your body if there's ever a need, and that's why we call it survival stuff. Now, some people use it every day. Other people just put it away, has a long, long year's expiration date, in case there's ever that moment where the power goes out, maybe there's an accident, maybe there's a hurricane, maybe there's a more serious event, in which case, for a period of time, they won't have food. In which case, they may not have cans or beans or nuts or seeds, but they've got their survival stuff. And that's important. So survival stuff it is. We only have 200 jars. And then it'll be about 4 weeks. We've got more of it in. It's a gallon. It's huge. Give a call. It's on special price. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065 for what is arguably the most comprehensive, all-inclusive, powerful, nutritional food that I could ever create. It's here. You have it. Use it or store it for that day when you're going to need it. And then you'll think, thank goodness I was smart enough to spend a little bit of money and have something that I can survive on now. Or use it daily. Survival stuff. It's got it all. On special price, 877-627-5065. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I want to say thank you to all the people who are now listening in around the world, over 170 different nations we have people listening. So we appreciate you being there, plus all the program stations around the United States who are carrying us. Thank you. I promised my own insights concerning the debate at Oxford that you just heard in defense of Islam. Plus, you've all heard the people who are challenging Islam, as Islam is a religion of violence, and therefore the intolerance and the segregation is completely acceptable. I bear to share a different argument. In recent years, there's been articles suggesting that Muslim invasions have been, cleansed from the historical discussions. Well, in point of fact, most religions have points that can be construed or taken literally as supporting violence. I'm going to use one example only. I could use others. We're going to look at India, because over the course of the 8 centuries, that's 800 years, genocide and Holocausts occur that could, in their total numbers, be anywhere between 60 to 80 million, depending upon the historians that are used, knowing that there's no complete or completely accurate way of determining all deaths. These reports can be traced back to neocon think tanks, neocon scholars in Islam, such as Daniel Pikes and fundamentalist Jewish and Christian sources. Their agenda is to present Islam as an inherently violent religion based upon jihad or holy war, with the intended goal to subdue all other peoples and nations. Islam has a very checkered history during the centuries of outside military infiltration and conquests in the Indian subcontinent. However, there was never a continuum of war, massacres, demolition of Hindu, Buddhist, and Sikh temples, and enslavement of other religious followers. For certain, there were individual Muslim conquerors, sultans, and emperors over the centuries who were ruthless and fanatical. They were genocidalist, and they chose to impose a strict literal interpretation of the principles of Islam and engage in violent measures. Mohammed of Ghazni in the 11th century and Timur in the 14th century were two of the more brutal conquerors who massacred hundreds of thousands of Indians, enslaved men and women and children, and destroyed Hindu and other religious holy places. Buddhists were especially hard hit, since they never held armies and prayer beads were no match for swords. In the case of Timur, even Muslim sultanates were not exempt. Delhi, which was already an established Muslim city, was devastated by Timur, and even Muslim women and children were enslaved. During this period, Muslims who had already been settled in India aligned with Hindu rulers and created coalitions to push back Timur's advances. During the latter Mughal Empire, founded by the enlightened ruler Emperor Akbar, who had attempted to found a new religion throughout the empire that would honor all religions based upon universal principles, there were periods when Islamic extremism turned violent. The ruler of the lineage of the 17th century was one of the worst. Later in the 18th century, another conqueror, Tipu Sultan, launched religious persecutions of Hindus, and who were called Hindus. By this time, Buddhism was almost completely eradicated in India. And of course, of the 8 centuries, it is fair to say that millions of lives, tens of millions, were either enslaved or destroyed. However, among these were also Muslims who were victims of rabid conquerors. One needs to remember that India was never a unified nation until gaining its independence from the British in 1948. Instead, it was a vast region divided among individual rulers, Hindu, Muslim, and Sikh. Frequent skirmishes and religious wars would exist among them over the centuries. However, these were categorically not religious, and conflicts of power and control over land and resources. Sultans would fight among themselves, as would Hindu rajas. One issue the followers of the Muslim genocide hypothesis fail to acknowledge is that, in general, Muslims migrating to India regarded Hindus as a people of the book, This is the basis for why Islam tolerated Christianity and Judaism in the Near East far more than did the Christians tolerate Jews and Muslims and even non-Catholic Christians during the period of the Crusades. Hindus had the Vedas, and the other texts which were regarded as divine revelations, and the belief that the Sant, Grahab, which is also regarded as a book of divine revelations by Muslims, although Muslim tensions among different groups was largely due to its religion's founders trying to blend together Islam and Hinduism. That is why even to this day, many Hindu families will raise one of their sons into a Sikh religion. There were also long periods of enlightened Muslim rulership in India. The rule of Zainu Bindin in Kashmir was a golden age of Islamic leadership that was the envy of the Emperor Akbar. Kashmir was home of many religious beliefs, including shamanism and Tibetan Buddhism. And Bindin set each day of the week a time where he would be instructed in spiritual teachings by a guru or a teacher of a different religion so he could acquire wisdom that he believed was found in all religions. He also had the Quran translated into Sanskrit and the Hindu holy text translated into Persian to further interfaith dialogue between his subjects. Akbar later did something rather similar. Emperor Shah Jahan, the builder of the Taj Mahal and another Muslim ruler with universalist beliefs, would have been followed by his son, Dara Shikhal, before being murdered by his fanatical Muslim brother. Today, India is faced not with the threat of growing Islamic extremism, but rather Hindu extremism that would like to rid Islam from the country. No religion is immune from fanaticism, fundamentalist extremism, and violence. Neither is atheism, as the Soviet Union and Mao's China have proven. Curiously, we find that the religions that have been most violent in the past are those who have scriptures that are believed to originate from a divine being, a god, or a transcendent source outside of human spiritual insight. These religions include Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Mormonism, and Hinduism. And although other religions like Buddhism, Jainism, Taoism, and Baha'i faith have texts that are regarded as sacred, they are not assigned to a cosmic, otherworldly author. And these religions are the most pacifist and lack clear prescriptions and demands to commit violent acts against other humans and nature. Without question, the Hebrew Torah and the writings of the later prophets are the most violent and have the clearest divine demands, in no uncertain terms, to murder, rape, and even commit genocide. How else can you interpret such verses as Deuteronomy 7:1-2, quote, "Why the Lord your God brings you into land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, then you must destroy them totally, make no treaty with them, and show them no mercy." Or Deuteronomy 20-16, "Do not leave alive anything that breathes. Completely destroy them, as the Lord your God has commanded you." One biblical scholar, Raymond Swagger, found 600 passages of explicit violence in the Old Testament, 1,000 verses where God's own violent actions of punishment are described, and 100 passages where God commands his followers to kill people. In fact, the only parallel example of what today would be regarded as a suicide bomber is found in the Jewish story of Samson, who sacrifices himself by bringing down a pagan temple, killing all the men, women, and children inside, and then prays by the Jewish God for his heroic act. Compare this to the Quran, where we find two surahs, the Surah Al-Anfal and the Surah Al-Tawbah, as repeatedly referenced by the opponents of Islam to denounce the Quran as a book based upon violence. While the quotes in Deuteronomy are explicit and cannot be interpreted metaphorically, this is not the case for references toward violence in the Quran, which are framed in the context of fighting as in warfare and not indiscriminate killing and murder of entire peoples, the sole exception of what might be broadly perceived as a command condoning genocide is, quote, from the Quran Surah, 2191, quote, and kill them wherever you find them and turn them out from where they have turned you out. And disbelief is worse than killing. But if they desist, then lo, Allah is forgiving and merciful, and fight them until there is no more disbelief. Now, three other clear genocides in the Old Testament are directly attributed to God. The worldwide flood that wiped out the entire human race except for Noah and his family. The Passover incident in Exodus, in which all of firstborn in Egypt were slaughtered. And the conquest of Canaan, where God orders the Hebrews to completely exterminate the indigenous people in the book of Joshua. Similar acts of violence are found throughout the Book of Mormon, with God's favorite people subduing and eradicating tribes of a different faith and belief system. Christianity is also not immune to violence, nor is the God of Jesus. Jesus understood as the exemplar upholding the Jewish law and commands of God, and therefore, by association, this would include approval of all the violent acts in the Hebrew Scriptures. We find this in Jesus' reference to Noah and the flood and God's destruction of the city of Sodom. But violence and genocide in the New Testament is mostly reserved for God determined to punish sinners with unquenchable fire and suffering in the abyss of a hell. And Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew 7-1-3 states most people will go to hell, and those who don't bear, quote, good fruit will be, quote, hewn down and cast into fire. As Jesus states, he was, quote, not come to send peace but a sword, Matthew 10:34. For cities that did not accept his teachings, he condemns it to dreadful deaths and torments in the afterlife. In fact, in the Gospel of Luke, God is compared to a slave owner who beats his slaves, quote, with many stripes. So in conclusion, today are we witnessing a surge in extremist and violent Hinduism intent on transforming India into a Hindu nation by force if necessary. The Hindu scriptures are not without their references to violence. The most frequent text that condones war and violence on behalf of the divine order is Bhagavad Gita, the story of the god Krishna admonishing the warrior Arjuna to give up his pacifism and take up the sword as a sacred deed towards liberation from the casual realm of human incarnation. The sacred Hindu epics, the Ramayana, and others are largely stories of battles, warfare, death, and destruction. Although very commonly misunderstood as a religion of pacifism and nonviolence, an image that has been reinforced by leaders like Gandhi and many Hindu yogis and gurus who became popular in the Western world, there was a caste set aside for the sole purpose of killing and warfare, the warrior caste, and who were born into a caste to implement the injunctions of the sacred Vedic texts by force if necessary. So, it is my opinion that if you choose to find some act of violence that you can support or participate or wrap a belief around, you will find them in the most of the Orthodox religions. But just as easily, you could use these as metaphors, and you could not interpret this as literal. And as a result, you could look for those statements within all these texts and within all these religions that support peace, harmony, moral equation, and living with respect and compassion for your other human beings on this earth. I think it's time that we examine this in a more enlightened state instead of the highly reactionary one that we're dealing with at this moment. Now let's go over and say hello to my guest standing by, Dr. Janine Wedel, though it's spelled W-E-D-E-L. I gave you her background earlier in the program, and we're here to talk about the emergence of a new and more sophisticated structure of power and corruption undermining our democracy and infiltrating every level of society. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
I'd like for you to give us an insight into this formation of a shadowy group of influential elite that emerged in the Soviet Union and later held immense power during the post-Soviet period. This was a model you identified that later served as the template for the emergence of a shadow elite operating in the United States and influencing the policies that shape the country and against the interest of the American people. And today, this loose network, as it were, has become extraordinarily powerful. It's my belief they are the most powerful policymakers, and they have the capacity and to influence public perceptions, perhaps more than lobbyists who usually take the brunt of our criticisms. So speak on the elite wielding power today, who they are, how they do it and how they've been virtually immune to our laws.
Okay, great. Well, I should first say that we're not just talking about one group. We're talking about different groups of elites. And what we've seen today is, as we all know, vast discrepancies in and growing discrepancies in income. So these elites have wielded influence and also got quite rich in the process. I began to understand the way in which these players operate when I worked in communist Eastern Europe, specifically Poland, in the 1980s and 90s, and watched how informal elite groups who had previously worked underground, as they had to under communism, both to get the resources that they needed, but also to have political influence. I began to see how they operated, as well as communist elites operated in the post-communist period. And that's where we got the oligarchs. That's how it is that instant billionaires came to be in places like the Russia. So, but what I've been trying to understand now is how these elites operate in the United States. And unfortunately, I see a lot of similarity. They span public and private venues at the same time, and crucially, they often have access to information from the inside. So let me just offer a few examples. So if we think about retired generals and admirals who sit on government advisory boards that give them privileged information, while at the same time they're being paid to advise military agencies, while also they're working as consultants to defense and intelligence contractors. And in fact, an investigation by the Boston Globe found that over the past few decades, these retired officers went mostly from actual retirement, that is, they stopped working when they retired from military service, to mostly continued service, meaning that they were working for the defense industry. In other words, 20 years ago, retired generals and admirals used to predominantly retire when they retired, and now they predominantly do not. So this is a long trend, and the problem for us, the public, is that they can use the information that they get in their government roles to use in their other roles. And we, the public, have no way of knowing whose interest they're working it for. So they can be pushing a defense project that is very costly and may not even really be in the national interest. So that's the way of operating a new way of operating in the military defense arena. If we move to, say, the healthcare arena, and think about what are called key opinion leaders or KOLs, have you ever heard of them? Well,
yes.
You probably many listeners have not, but you should have. These key opinion leaders are high status physicians or medical researchers who are paid or perked by pharmaceutical or medical device companies to convince their fellow professionals that a particular company's product is the best. And they don't disclose the KOLs don't disclose their sponsorship. So again, there's an information problem. And according to a study done by Queen's University in Kingston, these KOLs have tripled. The number has tripled in the past more decade plus. So the result is that you and I may go to our physician, and he or she may be unaware that their own judgment about a product or a treatment, course of treatment, has been swayed by one of these very high status key opinion leaders. So that's another arena where this way of operating is proliferating and has changed substantially in the past two decades. Yet another arena, academic economists. The University of Massachusetts at Amherst did a study that looked at the activities of 19 elite academic economists. These are people whose names you may well know. And they promoted specific financial reform proposals and advised governmental bodies and media in the run-up to and also just after the 2008 financial crisis, without disclosing that they also had links as consultants or board members to private financial institutions. So in other words, they were testifying before congressional committees and subcommittees. They were presenting themselves, they were in the media presenting their views, all without saying that, well, by the way, I'm not just an economist at a university, but I am also working for a particular industry or company. And again, the information problem. We, the public, have no way of knowing, easy way of knowing, that they are playing other roles, that these people are playing other roles that may well compromise their objectivity. So this is what we are faced with. This is the kind of conundrum that we, the public, are faced with today. This new style of corruption is entirely legal, and it can't be reduced to a quid pro quo type of corruption or the proverbial stack of cash. But those who practice it violate our trust, and their actions often affect our health and our security, our pocketbooks, and they also can lead to deep and lasting inequalities.
Okay. I appreciate the overview. If I'm hearing you right, and I'll take a broader perspective on this, then you hone it in. When you turn on television or radio, NPR, PBS, almost all the different networks, and you see a person who's there as an expert, more often than not, they're coming either from an academic background or from a think tank. And the think tank, nobody ever knows about these think tanks. No one's ever going to research them. They don't know the affiliation. But then the person is there to talk about why it's important to keep investing in the stock market. It's going up. It's healthy. It's not a bubble. It's good. It'll reach 20,000. Don't worry about anything else. We believe them because we have no vetting. We've assumed that the network itself or the source, the platform, would have done some vetting. Then we're not even aware that the people in the network themselves were selected, frequently from the Treasury, if it's a financial show, or from Goldman Sachs, to give their insights, again, which motivate a lot of people, create a perception of reality. And then we're told nothing of the person's conflict of interest, the people testifying on Capitol Hill, the people testifying in local or state committees are almost always affiliated with someone who's paying their bills, and we lose sight of this connection. So virtually every industry, big pharma, big energy, big media, they're all loaded with experts who do not have to sign in as a lobbyist. They can simply act as an expert with a think tank, and they're the ones guiding all this, but there's a hidden agenda behind it, and we, the public, are not being told what the truth is, and as a result, we pass laws. We go to war in Iraq, or we shouldn't. All the experts, Judith Miller, the New York Times, weapons of mass destruction, no one ever apologizes later, nor do we as a public say, you know, you were wrong. You with the largest number of economists in the world at the Federal Reserve, you were wrong. So why in the hell should we trust you in the future? Look at the consequences of you being wrong. We never held anyone accountable for being wrong ever about anything in our society. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think that yes, that some of the biggest players today obviously not only get off scot-free, but they also do what I call fail up. That is, they get promoted to bigger and better positions. And what I've been describing is fairly, you know, although corruption is an age-old problem, this way of operating, and I've studied it as an anthropologist, these means of operations are actually quite new, and they're on the rise, and they've been enabled by the rise of the digital age, which is, of course, a new, entirely new phenomenon in human history, and the end of the Cold War and mass privatization and so on. There's been a gutting of the media, as we know, and many journalists are unemployed, and television programs. You started off talking about TV and the expert that we see on TV. One of the problems is that stations and media outlets no longer have the resources to hire investigative reporters to go out and investigate stories. So what do? They put on experts, so-called experts. And, of course, the experts who want to go on very often have agendas. They're being paid not only by companies or industries, but also by billionaires who have agendas. Or they may be driven by ideology. That happens as well. But the point is that they're not giving us their objective opinion as experts, and we, the public, have, again, an information problem. We have no way of knowing without doing some investigation, and even then it will, some of their roles will be very, very difficult to suss out, and we'd have to devote practically all our time to it. So the message is that whenever you see, whenever somebody is identified simply as, say, former Homeland Security chief or former senator, former congressman, be suspicious. Ask yourself, what is that person doing now, and what might be their other agendas? Why are they on the air? What are they advocating? So that's a huge problem today. Right. The rise.
But you've risen it. You've raised the issue, and you've answered it. The book is Unaccountable: How Elite Power Brokers Corrupt Our Finances, Freedom, and Security. The author is Professor Jeanine Woudel. That's W-E-D-E-L, and she is a professor of social anthropology at the School of Policy, Government, and International Affairs at George Mason University. Thank you very much for being with us today. We look forward to a more in-depth discussion in the future. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you for listening. We're sorry to go late into Utrice's show, but we got our guests on a little late, so we'll say hello to Utrice. And Utrice, what do you have coming up today?
Well, Gary, we're talking about the ACLU challenging the Ferguson grand jury decision, and we're talking about hush money is not justice.
Excellent. Right now, Utrice Lade.